Good to see you this morning. Let's go ahead and open the class in prayer. Is there somebody who would like to volunteer to pray this morning? Steve. Amen. All right, today we're, I don't remember seeing your name on the row. Yeah, that's right. You should say what I usually say. I pay my tithes in this church. I can do what I want. Good to have you, though, brother. Today in this class, we're going to introduce chapter 2 in our text, Everyone an Answer, in which we'll review tactics for defending the faith. And this class, this is an important class, not because I'm teaching it, but because these are tactics that we are going to be reinforcing again and again and again and again all throughout the class, so that it's much easier for you to be able to give an apt answer quickly without being confused. Yes. Oh, it is chapter 3. Yeah. did any of you not read the chapter because of that mistake? Yeah, there, okay. Obviously you've Lolly, have you ever considered that the word tactic was not associated with chapter 2? All right. She read it. Okay. All right. Matthew chapter 10, verse 16 says this. You don't have to turn there. Jesus says, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves." All right. Be shrewd as serpents, but innocent as doves. Now, to be an effective lay apologist, we need to have at least two characteristics in addition to having a good character. All right? We need to have knowledge, enough knowledge that we can give an answer, and then we need to have wisdom, and there's some overlapping of the two, which we will define as the artful method of conveying that knowledge. Right? You need to have knowledge and you need to have wisdom, or the ability to artfully enter into dialogue with someone, to give a defense for the hope that is within you, to lead a person down the trail of Jesus Christ, notwithstanding their objections. Now, our overall strategy for people as Christians is that they might bring every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, 2 Corinthians 10:5. That they might be fully saved. And what I mean by that is that we're saved when we're justified, but every day we're being progressively made more holy, so that our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. And part of that is having our minds renewed, having a Christian worldview. There are a number of tactics in which we engage in order to achieve our overall strategy, right? Well, in our class, I want to first of all say that our tactics are not exhaustive. The ones that we are studying are not the only tactics. They're not the only silver bullets. There are other tactics that approach this from different angles that we could study. But we would like to introduce these tactics and rehearse them throughout our Christian worldview season because they are good. All right? They're good tactics for defending the faith. So please learn them and practice them, all right? And also have fun with them, because they are fun. Now, we're going to be looking at basically three main lines of tactics. The first one, as you'll look at your outline, is the Columbo approach. And under the Columbo approach, there are basically three kinds of questions that we will be learning to ask our unbelieving friends. The second line of tactic is the suicide approach, all right? And then the third is the taking the roof off approach. Now, the remaining two tactics, the suicide approach or the suicide tactic and the taking the roof off the house tactic, these are two tactics that I learned from Greg Kuchel on his tapes, which are available on standtoreason.com. He has a 5-tape series called Tactics for Defending the Faith, 5 MP3s that you can download for about $10, and they are excellent. I mean, I was just amazed at how helpful they are. You definitely get your money's worth in ordering those tapes. So if you want to go farther down the line of studying tactics, you can listen to those tapes, and they're fun enough. He's such an engaging speaker that you can listen to him again and again and again, and you don't get bored. He's just very, very good. So let's look first of all at the Columbo tactic. Now, if you read the chapter, you know that Columbo refers to, apparently, I don't know, I guess it was before my time, some TV character back then who played the role of a, I guess, an investigator, right? A police detective. And what was the characteristic of Columbo that is being utilized in our lesson? What was it about him that Greg Kuchel is taking and saying, hey, let's imitate Columbo in this way? All right. Very good. Apparently he would walk up and say, you know, I have a question here for you. Something's bothering me. Let me ask you a question. All right. And it seems so innocent, but his questions end up leading a person down a path to revealing whatever needs to be revealed. All right. And so we're going to take an approach that executes our tactics by asking questions. All right. Now, what are some of the benefits of learning to ask questions well? Just for your own, I didn't realize we had a ghost in this church. I didn't think they lived in churches, but what are some of the benefits of learning to ask questions well? It doesn't have to be from the book, just a couple that you can think of. Yes, Steve.
In terms of ordinary conversation, you can ask people questions, you don't have to conversation. Mm-hmm. And it tends to make them feel more comfortable. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Yes, Shelley. It's very true. Like it says in Scripture, when there are many words spoken, transgression is unavoidable, and even when a fool is quiet, he's considered to be wise, you know. So if you get a person talking, they end up revealing some things about themselves. Yes. Very good. Mm-hmm. It sure does. Well, there's a neat quote, actually, that kind of follows in that line from page 49 of our reading from Hugh Hewitt, who is a Christian who's on a secular talk radio program. He has his own program, and apparently he's pretty good. I understand that he's a lawyer. World Magazine issue? Okay. Does somebody have that page open by chance? Just raise your hand real quick. Could you read that little paragraph at the top of the page starting once developed?
Yes, once developed, and after asking the question, having looked at the advantage of the setting, one obviously has to have some situation, more information, and being an asker about controlling situations and statement figure, what you learn how to guide
Okay? And that's, we all know that that's true. Now, it does not mean that if you make statements, there's something wrong with that. In Scripture, we see examples of Jesus and the apostles making statements, making proclamations. In fact, it seems that we see more of that than we do of the disciples or of Jesus asking questions in bringing an apologetic encounter forward. The thing is that most of us are probably pretty good at making statements, right? We may need help about how to articulate an argument or how to articulate the gospel, but I know for me, at least, it's very easy for me to sit down and make a statement to somebody. Or if somebody brings up an objection, I just make a statement and go into a little spill about, you know, whatever the issue is. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? But learning to ask questions, I think, is something that all of us could grow by and really learn how to add that into our almost natural ability for many of us to make statements or just to make assertions. So we're going to focus on asking questions, and I've got to believe that in learning how to ask these questions very well, all of us are also going to be able to learn better how to make assertions even. Okay? So, Proverbs 15:23, a man has joy in an apt answer, and how delightful is a timely word. It's great when you're on the hot seat and an unbeliever has made an assertion and you quickly have the ability to turn around and ask a question that leads that apologetic encounter down in the right direction. A man has joy in an apt answer. And that's what we hope this will do for all of us. Now, Jimmy and I are part of the learning here. I don't think that I know that I've not at all come of age in learning how to ask questions. And my hope is that as we reinforce this through the season, all of us will grow together and learn how to ask questions well. Now, Jesus often asked questions to advance his agenda. One example is in Luke chapter 20, where he was approached, "Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But he detected their trickery. What did he say? He said, "Show me a denarius. Whose likeness and inscription does it have?" They said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." A great answer, an apt answer. He asked a question, got information out, and as it were, he hooked them into a dilemma by their own words. Okay. Earlier in that chapter, Luke chapter 20, verse 2, starting at verse 2, and I won't read all of it, but, "And they spoke, saying to him, Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things? Or who is the one who gave you this authority? Jesus answered and said to them, I will also ask you a question." All right? And he sets up a question that puts them into a dilemma. All right? He says, "Was the baptism of John from heaven or from men?" Well, he knew that they wouldn't be able to answer that question, because they reasoned among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say, why did you not listen to him? But if we say from men, we're afraid of all those people out there who regard him as a prophet. We'll get stoned to death." So he said, "Well, we don't know." He says, "Well, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." Just a great apt answer to shut the mouth of the fool. All right. Now, that may sound like strong language, but one of the verses that that we will use in justifying, especially the reducto ad absurdum approach, is Proverbs chapter 26, verse 4. "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him. Answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he will not be wise in his own eyes." So there are questions like the one Jesus just did, asked. He asked a question to the fool. The fool was trapped by Jesus' question, and consequently, the fool was no longer wise in his own eyes, or certainly wasn't wise in the eyes of others. So, moving along, Greg Kuchel says in page 49, "Generally, when I ask a question, I have one of three goals in view." And if you look at your outline, these are A, B, and C under the first main point of the Columbo approach. He's looking either to gain information with a question, to gain information, or to reverse the burden of proof, or number three, to exploit a weakness. Those are the three main categories. All right. Let's look at the first one, to gain information. What we're looking here for are questions that seek for clarification, to gain information. These are very passive questions. They're easy to ask. Basically, you're only asking, what you're asking are what questions. What? What do you mean by that? What exactly do you mean by so-and-so? When you say that that abortion is wrong because, when you say that abortion is fine because a fetus is not a human, what do you mean by a fetus? What do you mean by being human? These are questions that seek to merely get information. What do you mean by that? Now, when we ask questions like this, we need to pay very careful attention to the answer so that we don't misrepresent it, right? We might even recite it back to ourselves. If you turn to page 50, starting right at the very top where it says, "There is no God," page 50, right at the top where it says, "There is no God," could somebody read some of these examples from "There is no God" down to "It's only your interpretation"? Somebody have that available to read it? Henry, if you could do that. You get the feel of it? Here, I'll ask you one. The Da Vinci Code has proven that Jesus is not God. How would you give me a clarification question? There you go. What do you mean proven? All right. Let me ask, what would be another question you could ask from that assertion? The Da Vinci Code has proven that Jesus Christ is not God. Who do you say that he is? Yeah? Yeah, what do you mean by God? That might be good. All right, and there really aren't a whole lot of opportunities with that one. I think Jimmy hit it especially on the nail with that one. Can anybody else think of an assertion that you often hear from unbelieving friends? Faith is irrational. How would you do that? How would you respond? What do you mean by irrational? How about a more broad one? What exactly do you mean? That's very broad. You don't even have to focus in on the word irrational, although in some contexts it might be good to exploit a specific part of the assertion. Faith is irrational. What do you mean by faith? What do you mean by irrational? What exactly do you mean by that? Now you're talking about the whole broad swath of the question. Then you just sit back and listen. Let the unbeliever clarify his position. Now, the value of this is that we're not assuming that we know what exactly he's saying. How many times have you been in a conversation, either in terms of apologetics or not, and somebody makes an assertion, and you respond to it elaborately, and the person is someone who's not like me. They sit there and wait. You know, I will talk. But the person sits there and listens to my response, and then later on he says, "Well, actually, that's not what I meant. Oh, I just wasted a lot of breath there." You know, so it's good to ask these questions. If an unbeliever makes an assertion, an unbeliever may be flattered in some measure by our asking for clarification. All right? It's not necessarily a negative thing. Yeah, exactly. Just exactly like what you said, that the other person... there's a sense in which the other person is honored, graced by your asking a question. You're showing interest in that person's view. Now, so that's the first set of questions. Basically, what questions? What do you mean by that? What do you mean by this? What do you mean by what you said? Okay? You're getting information. Now, the second kind of Columbo question is the reverse the burden of proof questions. Here you're trying to learn their reasons for their assertion. And Greg Kuchel brings up the example of a house. All right? The roof of the house is their belief or their assertion. The walls of the house are their reasons for supporting their belief. All right, so here are their reasons. The first question says, please clarify me, what exactly do you mean by your assertion, your belief, whatever it is that you're saying? The second question throws the burden of proof upon them. Oh, really? Well, how did you come to that conclusion? Or what are your reasons for believing that? Now, when an unbeliever makes an assertion, she bears the burden of proof to support it. We should not think that simply because an unbeliever makes an assertion that we need to go on the defense and start defending the gospel. If an unbeliever just brings up an assertion like, you know, well, let's do it. Well, the Da Vinci Code has proven that Jesus Christ is not God. What's your first question? What do you mean by proof? Well, what I mean by proof is that there's a lot of documentation in that book that shows that it was a myth. What would be the burden of proof question you would ask me? That's it. How did you come to that conclusion? What specifically, you don't even have to use the form of words. How did you come to that conclusion? Although I found that for me, it's usually always good to learn the form of the words first, and then after you get comfortable with it, then you start to improvise, just like with what you did. What exactly is the burden of proof? Or could you share with me your reasons for coming to that conclusion? Now, the burden of proof is upon the unbeliever. What we tend to do is that as soon as the unbeliever says, well, the Da Vinci Code says this, we say, well, the Da Vinci Code, blah, 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 blah. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. And at times, that is the appropriate response. But what we may find is that by just sitting back and asking a question, the unbeliever will hang herself. You ask her, what exactly do you mean by the Da Vinci? How did you come to believe that Jesus is not God by reading the Da Vinci Code? And then she begins to articulate her arguments. Maybe she hasn't thought through some of them. Maybe even when she vocalizes them, she sees how weak they are. She starts kind of, you know, squirming a little bit in her seat. You will find that people make assertions all the time that they've never had to defend or that they never thought about defending. Maybe they take them as self-evident. Oftentimes, their defense will be poorly thought out. And you're asking a question, places the burden of proof on them and lets them sit in the squirmer's seat for a while they give us more and more information. Now, let me give you some examples. I'm going to make some assertions, and what I want you to do is ask me some burden of proof questions. Okay? And again, the form of the question is, how did you come to that conclusion? What are your reasons for believing that? All right, you ready? Evolution is a fact. Okay, what do you mean by evolution? Now, that would be a fact-finding question, right? The first kind of Columbo. Ask me now the second kind, the burden of proof.
What do you mean by fact?
What do you mean by fact? All right, again, now that's the first category of question, right? It's a what question. You're seeking for information about clarification. How about looking for my reasons? That's right. What are your reasons for believing that? How did you come to that conclusion? All right. Really? Why do you believe that? It's simply a why question. This one is asking, what exactly is it that you believe? This one is asking, why do you believe it? So the burden of proof question, let's do another one. Psychology has proven that God is merely a projection of our need for the perfect Father. Ask me a burden of proof question. This is a kind of the Freudian thing, okay? Psychology has proven that God is merely a projection of our need for the perfect Father. How did you come to that conclusion? Oh, you know, I heard it in her mind. She remembers something way back in the dark labyrinth of her college days when Freud maybe was more popular than he is now. It's just a seed thought from a professor that she had a crush on. Okay? And she said, but it sounded very sophisticated up front, right? So now you ask the question, and Freud said that. Freud said that. Have you ever considered that Freud is regarded by most people today to be wrong on a great deal of what he taught? You see what I'm saying? a lot of people have not thought about what they believe. Capital punishment is immoral. First of all, I'll ask one of those questions. Well, I mean, it just, you shouldn't kill people. You shouldn't kill people. What, now ask me a...
Why not?
Now... That's right. How did you come to the conclusion that capital punishment is immoral? That's what you're saying, right? Because you do, you don't want to just ask what and why, and that's not, and I know that you clarified what you were going to ask, because you want to lead it somewhere. Remember, in your asking questions, you're leading the unbeliever down a path for his good and for your good, for the ultimate good that unbeliever's wrong belief will be corrected. So you don't want to just be asking what questions and why questions without any direction. You want to think about their assertion, ask a what question, ask for a burden of proof question that leads you down the path. All right? All right, so we've got the reverse the burden of proof. Now the next one, to exploit a weakness. All right. Now we are going on the offensive. The previous two questions were very passive, you know. What exactly do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? What do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? Those are the first two Columbo tactics. Now, the third Columbo tactic, the exploiting a weakness tactic, now we know what your friend believes. We know why he believes it by asking your questions. Now you may ask more questions to exploit a discovered weakness in his beliefs. So, you've asked what he believes, and you have a good understanding of it. You've also got a good understanding, and you've listened carefully to how exactly did you come to that conclusion? What are your reasons for believing that capital punishment is immoral? And you've listened carefully. The reason for asking the first two lines of questions is to provide data so that you can scan that data through the eyes of a Christian worldview and find inconsistencies, or find a matter that you can exploit, a weakness, okay? You've listened carefully to what he says, and now you see the weakness in that person's argument. We'll give you some examples. All right, so this is asking the question. You don't necessarily have to be, when I say that it's an offensive question, that doesn't mean that it's offensive, okay? It doesn't have to be belligerent or proud or haughty or anything like that. We can ask it very nicely. Have you ever considered that? And then you make your assertion. You are really, at this stage, you are, in a sense, you can be even making assertions yourself, but you're simply putting them in the form of a question. You follow me? There are some examples on page 54. Now, since I think only two people brought their books today, we'll have the same two people flipping back and forth. All right, no, seriously. Does anybody else have a copy of the book who would like to read some of these examples on page 54? We would be looking at, starting around the first third of the page, the fetus may be a human being, and then we would just finish that by, but if there is no God. Somebody want to read those? Steve? Okay. All right. Now, obviously, this tactic requires insight. The first two tactics are much easier. You're just gathering information. But the exploit a weakness tactic is actually your response to what the unbeliever has actually said. You're no longer just asking what questions and why questions. You're still asking questions, but in your questions, you're exploiting a weakness. So, for example, let's take the first one that Steve read for us. The fetus may be a human being, but it's not a person. What's the difference? Now, that's not merely a belief question. It's not merely a reasons question. Now you're actually exploiting a weakness. What is the difference between a fetus and a human? See what I'm saying? A human and a person. Fuse may be a human being, but it's not a person. Yeah, you're right. That's very good. Yeah, that's exactly right. What's the difference between a human being and a person? Do you see the weakness? you can soften the approach by asking, have you ever considered, and if you look on the page, have you ever considered that the existence of evil is actually evidence for the existence of God and not against it? Somebody says, well, you know, the Bible was only written by men, so how can it be true? And you say, well, have you ever considered that if the Bible were merely written by men, it would be very hard to account for fulfilled prophecy? Do you see that? Now, you're making an assertion by asking a question. You're not merely clarifying his belief or finding out what his reasons are for his belief. You've already got his reasons, and you already understand his belief, but you see a weakness. And the assertion to which you're responding in this case is, well, the Bible is only written by men. Well, if it were only written by men, don't you think it'd be hard to account for fulfilled prophecy? Well, the next question that he may ask you is, what do you mean by fulfilled prophecy? Now he's asking you the what question, but it may give you a platform to share. I don't necessarily feel that we always need to be in the question-asking seat, and I've already said that. Certainly Jesus and the apostles many times made assertions without questions, if not regularly did that. But for those of us who work in, you know, modern 21st century offices and work environment, we realize that we have politically correct straitjackets on us. And it's much easier for us to share our faith or to interact with people at the lunch table asking questions than it is making direct assertions. If you ask a question and let the other person hang himself with it, it's very hard for that person to drag you into human resources and say that you're trying to preach your faith to him. See what I'm saying? It's a lot easier. Even politicians can do it. No, I'm just kidding. That theme keeps coming up. And by the way, I'm a salesperson, so maybe we probably want to shift it from the politician stuff to the salesperson stuff. Yeah, just like a salesperson, you know. Last class we had a whole bunch of salespersons, and we also had lawyers. A lawyer or two in the class, so I mean, it was great. You know, every statement that was made was always against Mike Clark or me. All right, I'm going to... we've looked at some examples of this tactic. Now, I realize that this tactic, since we've only spent a few minutes on it, I realize that there's a lot more that we could spend on this. And in fact, the rest of our Christian worldview season is going to be, you know, learning that tactic, especially more and more, how to respond to specific problems that we see, how to exploit weaknesses, how to ask questions. But right now, what we would love for all of us to do is that right now, start thinking about these three lines of questions. Just start thinking about them. When things come up in conversations that you observe on TV or at a restaurant, start thinking, what would have I asked in that situation? How would have I asked this? Or I heard the reasons of this person's view. Where was the weakness there? There's something that's bothering me about what that person said. Where's the weakness? Well, that's right. That's where the weakness is. Okay. Now, let me think about how I would exploit that weakness with a question, have you ever considered that? All right. It takes practice. And like anything, did any of you ever go through Evangelism Explosion, D. James Kennedy's Evangelism Explosion? Sometimes Evangelism Explosion is criticized by Reformed Baptists for certain weaknesses, but at least they're evangelizing. And they're doing a pretty good job of it. And I learned so much about evangelism simply by learning the diagnostic questions. If you were to die today and stand before God and he were to ask you, why should I let you into my heaven, how would you respond to that? And once you memorize those questions, then you begin to improvise a little bit on them, ask them in a different way. And it's amazing the amount of information that you can uncover and how you can really bring the whole evangelistic opportunity forward. And so in the same way with these tactics, if you learn the form of the questions and then learn how to skillfully identify weaknesses in people's answers, it can be very effective. So we're moving on to the next tactic, the suicide tactic. All right, what are we talking about with suicide tactic? And I'm sorry I'm moving along so quickly here. There's actually a lot of material, and I want to make sure we cover it today. The suicide tactic. Well, the suicide tactic is focusing on responding to self-refuting claims or claims of sibling rivalry. And I'll explain the latter in just a minute. An illustration. Charlie Brown is sitting in the room watching TV, and Lucy walks in. Lucy walks in and she says, "No, no, no, no. My new philosophy is no." And then Charlie Brown says, "Really? Is that your new philosophy?" She goes, "Yes. I mean, no. I mean, oh, you ruined my new philosophy." All right. That's an example that Greg Kugel gives. These are statements that cannot satisfy their own standards. These are statements that are irrational, taken in themselves. Within the statement itself, there is a self-refutation. Not even God can make these kind of statements true, because God cannot make contradictions true. God is a rational being. He carries out all of his plans according to his most holy, wise, and powerful preserving and governing of all of his creatures and all their actions. God does not make a square a circle. He doesn't make a circle a square. All right? These are self-refuting assertions that don't even meet their own requirements. And our ability to see them and then to respond to them can be of great value when we're dealing with people. Now, let me give you some examples. One example that I heard on the tapes was by Yogi Berra, the baseball player. "You should always go to other people's funerals or they will never go to yours." There's a clear, humorous example of a self-refuting statement, right? Clearly self-refuting. God could make it true by saying God could raise him from the dead and bring him to your funeral, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, these are things that just are not true. These are statements that do not meet the demands of the law of non-contradiction. Jimmy will be talking about this. Simply to say that A cannot be A and not A at the same time and in the same way. It cannot be the case that both my Volkswagen is in the parking lot and that my Volkswagen is not in the parking lot at the same time and in the same way. That's a contradiction, right? So the law of non-contradiction here is what we're looking at. Now let me give you some examples of self-refuting statements. "I cannot speak a word of English." What would be an answer to that? Okay, that's good. How would you put that in a question?
"What language are you speaking now?"
Didn't you just communicate that to me in English? You know? "You cannot know anything for sure." How many of you heard that before? We can't know anything for sure. How do you refute that with just we're not even looking at a clarification or a reasons belief. We're looking at... That's right. How do you know that for sure? You see what I mean? And then the unbeliever says, "Oh, you never thought about that." How many people make statements like that all the time? "We can't know anything for sure." Usually if it's about religion, "We can't know anything about God for sure." Excuse me, you said we can't know anything about God for sure. But yeah, but how do you know that we can't know anything about God for sure? Do you know that for sure? What? Oh, I never thought about that. I'm actually making a statement about the knowledge of God with certainty, and my assertion is that you can't know anything for certain about God. That's a contradiction. You see what I mean? "My brother is an only child." Now, that's kind of a funny one. It's ridiculous, but it's funny. How about this one? Now, I want somebody to respond to this one, not with this kind of question or that kind of question, but with an actual response. "Have you ever considered that?" Or a response similar to Shelley's, where you're exploiting the weakness. You're showing the contradiction. "You should never push your morality on other people." How many of you heard that before? "You should never push your morality on other people." Now that is a self-contradiction. Where's exploit it for me? That's right. Very good. Are you telling me to do that? Expand on that a little bit. Expand on it. I mean, help the person to see that she's pushing her morality on you.
Are you telling me to say she pushed my beliefs on other people?
That would be a good one. Yes, Jimmy? Yes, it is. Then why are you pushing your beliefs on me? You know, something like that. You know, that's very good. That's the point. And again, it takes skill to see it, but that is one of the most common things that everybody says, and it's self-refuting. Because what I'm saying is, you should never push your morality on another person. And then you ask, really? Well, then why are you pushing your morality on me? Oh, I never thought about that before. Because that is a moral statement. You're saying you ought not to push your morality on another person. That is a moral assertion itself, and you're pushing it on someone. There are no moral absolutes. Are you absolutely sure there are no moral absolutes? How about this one? This will be the last one we look at for this one. The scientific method is the only way to discover truth. How many of you have heard stuff like that on TV? The scientific method is the only way to discover truth. Jimmy, you want to take a crack at this one? There you go. Now, really, you think that's funny, but did you discover that through... Now, if the person says, oh, we just know it's true, you say, did you... Well, we just know it's true.
Did you use the scientific method?
Well, no, you can't prove that by the scientific method. See it? Scientific method cannot justify the proposition that science is the only way to discover truth. Yes, Steve? I think so.
I think, though, that Bell book and Buddy Trend is possibly the person we start talking about that I'm not sure I'm going to be the general puppy law that I can't sure. Whereas, if you go straight to the point, then you're kind of caught with a really small people.
That's a great point. All right. So, the self-refuting claims. They're fun. Watch for them. You'll be hearing them more than you think. Yes?
What does it mean to say that
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Present the gospel, you know, but it's so easy to say, you know, well, why aren't you doing that to me? You know,
mm-hmm.
It would be more of a...
You could say it very bluntly, and you may not want to do that in some situations.
So
what would be a good way? What would be a good way to gently respond to that one?
Well, it seems almost like you're pushing it on me, you know, in a way.
There you go.
You know, I mean, just kind of
mm-hmm.
softening.
Or, Sally, have you ever considered that when you say that, you're pushing your morality on me? You can say it very kindly, you know. Now, so your personality type, you're much more like my wife, and that's a good thing. That's why I love my wife. She's nice and I'm mean. For me, it's a lot easier to make more direct statements. And that's not always a good thing. I'm just saying, though, that you also got to be comfortable within your own personality type as well. And also the degree of friendship you have with somebody. There are some people that you don't want to be blunt with. And there are other people, I mean, if you're working with them all day long and every now and then they're joking with you and stuff and they make an assertion like that, you can turn around and say, well, then why are you pushing your morality on me? I mean, you can say it. So it's person variable, it's situation variable, Joseph Fletcher, situational ethics. All right, sibling rivalry. This is the second kind of suicide tactic. And simply this, sibling rivalry is when sometimes objections come to us in pairs, right? They come to us in pairs. We hear an objection early on in the discussion, and then we hear another assertion later on in the discussion, and they both stand out like two big red sore thumbs as contradictions. They come to us in pairs, and these pairs are logically inconsistent with one another. We can point out this contradiction and remove at least one of the objections. If they're contradicting one another, and we point that out to them, maybe we can remove one of the objections so that they stay consistent. All right, let me give some examples, and I want you to find where those examples are. And now these are much more difficult, all right? Boy, it's hot in here. I'm partly joking with you on that. It's better than it was before. Yeah. Yes. It needs to be a little bit cooler, I would say so. I'm going to stand right here. But it's honestly, it's not that bad. I'm just joking with you. We're finally getting to the root of this matter. That's a good thing, because last year it was just, we died. It was just so, it was super hot in the wintertime and freezing in the summertime. All right, here are some examples. I'll give you two assertions that are made in this long discussion you're having with people. Here's the first one. Well, natural selection got us here and made us into the amazing creatures that we are. Ready? I'm going to say it again. Well, natural selection is what really got us here and made us into the amazing creatures that we are, later on in the discussion. We shouldn't oppress other animals since they've got as much a right to be here as we do. We shouldn't oppress other animals because they've got as much a right to be here as we do. Where is the contradiction? First of all, does somebody tell me where is the contradiction there? You don't have to articulate it in a question. Steve?
I think it's the issue of natural selection versus right to be in a naturally selected frame of mind.
That's right.
Now, if I'm here because I want, then what's wrong with you winning?
That's it. That's the key. That's the key. Now, let's try and be really creative. Try and put that in a question. All right? It's not easy, but see if anybody can try and put that in a question. It might even be an assertion prefaced by, have you ever considered that if natural selection is what got us here, how would you do it? There you go. How many have you have heard this kind of reasoning go on in people? It goes on all the time. The people who espouse neo-Darwinism also are against any type of smell of racism. Except, in fact, everything is racism. If you make a statement against a culture, and if that culture is somehow associated with a minority, irrespective of the DNA of the minority, we're talking about a cultural thing, not a DNA thing. It's racism, right? But isn't racism really the natural outflow of neo-Darwinian thought? Now, the races came because they were the differentiating characteristics of each race came into being because of the environments in which they were galvanized through the ages. Africans have dark skin because they lived in places where there was a lot of sunshine for long periods of time, and nature selected out that aspect of the gene pool that enabled them to survive better by having a dark skin, right? So you can easily see how that people, on the one hand, can praise natural selection and neo-Darwinianism as the principle that got us where we are today, and then on the other hand, act like it's wrong to help the process of natural selection on, right? Okay, next question, or the next example. Moral law is based on the consensus of a given society. It is a societal specific standard. Then later on in the conversation, the Germans were just plain wrong to execute the Jews. Where's the contradiction? What's that? Okay. Well, give me the contradiction between the two, though. What is it that is the contradiction? That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. It sounds like you're bringing some kind of a more universalized moral judgment upon a given society, whose society made its own morality. It's okay to execute Jews. And you just said that was what moral law is. It is merely society specific. You follow me on that? I don't know if we were clear enough on that. All right, we're going to have to move along, though, for the sake of time. God doesn't exist because there is so much evil in the world. That one's a little more difficult, and we'll actually explore that in the moral argument. The answer might be, well, have you ever considered that if God doesn't exist, then there is no standard for discerning between good and evil? See the contradiction? How can there be absolute evil in the world if there is no God? Doesn't make sense. There has to be an infinitely good person who serves as the criteria or standard of morality for you to be able to differentiate evil from good, who is God. And that will be later on as we talk about ethics and also the moral argument. All right. Moving on, taking the roof off tactic. This is one I'm going to rush through in 5 minutes. You ready? This is the favorite tactic of presuppositionalists like Greg Bahnsen and Cornelius Van Til. Even more modified presuppositionalists like Francis Schaeffer used to love to use the taking the roof off tactic. And in this tactic, you adopt the person's point of view, the other person's point of view, for the sake of argument. You adopt their position for the sake of argument. Then you press it to its logical conclusion, which results in an absurdity. This is also called the reductio ad absurdum. Many of you have heard that. It's a Latin phrase meaning reducible to absurdity or something like that. Isn't that right? Is that what that means? Reducing to absurdity. Now, the thought behind this tactic is that since unbelievers live in God's world, their beliefs and philosophies about the world that are contrary to God's truth will lead to absurdities. Does that make sense? Unbelievers live in God's world. They breathe the air that He's given to them. They are subject to His moral law. They're subject to His laws in general. So that when they invent philosophies or false beliefs about the nature of the world in which they live or about the nature of God, probably their beliefs are going to be reducible to absurdity because it's not those beliefs don't have any application in the real world. So, in other words, unbelievers have built roofs over their heads. They've built roofs over their heads to relieve the tension of their false beliefs. And with this tactic, we remove the roof and expose the absurd consequences to which their unbelief or their false belief leads. And we already read Proverbs 26, answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he would not be wise in his own eyes. Three main steps on how to do this. First of all, reduce the point of view to its basic premise or assertion or its basic moral rule. An example. In an argument about moral absolutes, you appeal to God as the ground of moral law. God is the standard. But your unbelieving friend asserts, I believe that material is all there is. How could you reduce that point of view to its basic premise? You could say this. So basically what you're saying then, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the material is all there is. Basically what you're saying is that really all things just boil down to matter in motion. Is that right? I never thought about it that way, but that is true. If everything's material, everything ultimately boils down to just molecules banging against one another, atoms, electrons, protons, whatever is out there that has a material quality. Second step, give it a test drive. Let's give that a test drive. If this assertion is true, where will it take me if I follow it consistently? Well, if you're saying that all things are basically matter in motion, and if I am merely matter in motion, what ethical significance can we learn from the random collisions of atoms? Follow me? Yeah, that's right. Nihilism. They look and they look out there and they see there's no meaning to anything. If everything just boils, if somebody says, well, I just believe that matter is all there is, and a lot of people say that, then you first step, reduce it down to its most simple assertion or expression. So basically what you're saying then is that everything just boils down to molecules combining and interacting with one another, right? That's what ultimate reality really is. We just happen to be more complex configurations of molecules interacting with one another, right? Yeah, that's right. Well, if I'm merely matter in motion, and if all is merely matter in different states of motion and configuration, what ethical significance can we learn from the random collision of atoms? I never thought about it that way. How can I derive moral absolutes from the random collision of atoms? That's what ultimate reality is. Then invite that person to consider the implications you just reflected on and the absurdity that follows from the reductio. And that's what we did. And I'll close with an example that I faced recently. I'm sitting at a table, veterinarian sitting here. One of his staff members is sitting across from me. She's a young girl. She says, my fiancé moved in with me because of finances. But I don't normally agree with living together before marriage, and I really feel bad about it. The veterinarian sitting next to me says, trying to comfort her, he says laughingly, he says, but the cohabitation laws of North Carolina no longer apply and are not enforced. Right? So he says, but the cohabitation laws of North Carolina no longer apply and are not enforced. Here's a response I could say to reduce it to absurdity. Would you say that moral law receives its validity only from civil law? Would you say that moral law receives its validity only from civil law? If so, then there's nothing morally wrong with your next door neighbor lying to you all the time, since civil law doesn't apply to such cases. You cannot have a moral complaint against your neighbor lying to you because there are no laws against your neighbor lying to you. In other words, anybody who says that moral law is the same as or only extends as far as civil law is going to have problems with all problems calling anything immoral outside of that small circle. Namely, when you're unbelieving, when your neighbor lies to you every time you turn around, you better not make any moral judgments against that person because what he's doing is legal. You see the absurdity that results out of that? Now, I did not say that. But when I thought about it afterwards, and I don't think that they would have even agreed to the second question, when I would have asked, would you say that moral law receives its validity only from civil law? I think they would have said, no, we wouldn't say that. And I think that that in itself would have been enough to reverse the thing. But if they had held on to the assertion, yeah, I think that, you know, moral law is only as wide as civil law is, then you could have even carried it further and reduced it to its absurdity. So I hope that's helpful. Read the chapter if you haven't read it. And then, of course, next class period, Jimmy will be going over logic, which will be very interesting and helpful. And we'll be reinforcing these principles all the way through the year. All right? You are dismissed.